Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by a musician and producer whose CV includes Ride, Hurricane No. 1, Oasis, and BDI, as well as Glock. It's Andy Bell. Hello.
Hello, Chris.
How are you?
I'm very well. It's a lovely sunny day in London.
Yeah.
Exactly the kind of weather that I associate with Revolver for some reason.
Yeah.
It's a sort of London-y album.
It is, yes. Carnaby Street and sunshine. And...
yeah.
So just before you start, because last year you released your debut album, The View From Halfway Down, and now you've reinvented yourself as Glock. Tell me about that.
Well, both of these things, I mean, I guess the Glock thing was happening anyway before the lockdown thing kicked in, but lockdown certainly has increased the amount of music I've been putting out. The solo record started off as a 7-inch, which came out on a singles club, and that was in 2019. But I'm someone that has the kind of, having done one record in my head, I kind of felt like there has to be a continuation from this, and I was going to do a single about a year later, but then when the lockdown happened, it sort of became an album.
Oh, right.
Because of just I had so much time to go through recordings that I'd made, and I had done quite a lot of recording with my ex-Oasis and BDI bandmate, Gem Archer, and left a lot of recordings kind of just sitting half done, half completed. So I went back and dug some of those out and made them into an album.
Cool. So is that kind of the reason you made a solo album? Because it took quite a while, didn't it?
I mean, it grew from this single to a 12-inch EP and then into an album. And it's 8 tracks. It was just really hard to compile the right ones. So I kept giving myself more room to get it right. So from 2 tracks to 4 tracks, and then, well, which 4? And then when I had a shortlist of 8, I was like, well, why can't I just make an album? So I just said to the guy at the label, could I actually do an album instead? He said, yeah, just change the speed, it's fine.
What, slow them all down?
Yeah.
Get a drop
from 45 to 33. Yeah. Yeah. So from 45 to 33 is as easy as it was to do it.
Brilliant. So tell me, first of all, when did you discover the Beatles? How did you get into them?
Okay, so it's through my dad. So I'm 51 years old now.
Never.
And my dad went to college in the mid-60s. And while he was at college, there was 3 Beatles albums out, and he bought those ones. It was With the Beatles, Hard Day's Night, and Beatles for Sale. So they were in the house, although most of the records in my parents' house or our family house, they were all like classical. But I had access to these 3 Beatles records, plus a couple of the early EPs. I think it was Twist and Shout, which has got a really cool sleeve.
Oh, yes. I think
they're standing on a wall, and there's a black shiny Mac. Someone's got a black shiny Mac on. It looks really cool.
Is that the Long Tall Sally one, actually, I think?
Oh, that could be Long... yeah, it was that Long Tall Sally and Twist and Shout, which is them... Twist and Shout is them jumping in the air, isn't it?
That's it, right. Yeah. Oh, Long Tall Sally. Yes. Yeah. Super cool.
Yeah, what a sleeve. And apart from those Beatles records, there was just a Scott Joplin album and Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water, and then all this classical music. So I just gravitated towards these Beatles records and wore them out, basically. So I was just really, as a small child, I was kind of drawn into it. And used to love that song, Tell Me Why. That was like the one I loved as a little kid.
Yeah.
Tell me why I cry. And why you lie to me. And then, so the age I was, which is I think the same for a lot of my friends as well, there was kind of 2 big moments that happened. And you might be able to help me to put them in order. But obviously John Lennon was killed in 1980. I'd have been 10 then. I feel like I was already kind of getting into the Beatles at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, they'd broken up 10 years before, but culture moves slowly, doesn't it? So
yeah,
it was still the Beatles world. It was still the Beatles, you know, Beatles country.
Yeah.
10 years later, when he was shot, they were still so big. And I mean, worldwide, weren't they?
Mm, absolutely.
And so kind of relevant still. It was still like they were still in the news. And then there was a Christmas where they showed the Beatles films over the period of the Christmas week. So do you know what year that was?
I'm pretty sure that was 79.
Was it?
Prior to that.
That early?
Yeah, because I definitely saw it, and they had Shea Stadium as well. Because
Shea Stadium, yeah.
I think it was 79. I've had this conversation before, but I definitely remember that because they showed Help on the night John died, and I'd already seen it before. So, yeah, 79.
Right. So, right. Well, that was probably my first exposure beyond the Beatles albums in the house. And so then, yeah, that makes sense, because by the time John Lennon was shot, I was already quite a big fan. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I had two mates at school that were into the Beatles as well, and used to sort of like get hold of another Beatles record, and that would be shared with the little group, you know.
Yeah.
So my mate Richard had a big sister, and it was through her that he had come to school with tales of like Strawberry Fields Forever and stuff. He said, oh, there's some really weird stuff. You want to hear this weird Beatles stuff? And like I Am the Walrus and stuff.
Because I guess you'd only heard the early stuff up to that point with your parents' records.
Well, you only hear what you're exposed to. People our age will understand this, but there was no easy access to music without someone playing it to you or you buying it yourself. And I remember there was a neighbour down the road that had some Beatles records, and so he'd mentioned it to my dad. Oh, Andy can come and hear Abbey Road one day. So I went, this is a bit later on, I was probably about 13 at this stage, and went down the road to the neighbour's house and sat there listening to Abbey Road. But very good to hear it all that way. Oh yeah, and me and my dad used to go to record fairs. So I grew up in Oxford, and Oxford Town Hall used to do the, you know, big record fairs once or twice a year, I guess. And I'd save up a few pounds and get like one or two new Beatles records. So I got Magical Mystery Tour that way, and I guess I got Revolver that way, because it wasn't one of the first few that I already had in the house. So gradually completed the collection.
Superb.
So yeah, that was the introduction.
And the album that you've picked today is Revolver. So why this one in particular?
Well, I've been a long time listener to your brilliant podcast. And since there was a period of intense listening about a year ago when I was painting the house.
Oh, really?
I went through so many. I went through probably all the episodes I could get hold of at the time.
Oh, wow.
And I kind of noticed a theme that people do tend to choose obscure choices. And so I was always thinking, oh, I bet if I go back and find, I bet everyone starts off with all these real classic ones. I don't know, has Revolver been done a lot of times?
I think it was the second or third episode did it once, yeah.
So you've done it once before. Well, I hope I don't repeat too much. But I thought... Funnily enough, Felix White did the podcast recently, and I really enjoyed his take on the Isha demos. Is it Isha or Esha?
I say Isha.
Yeah.
But then I say Potato.
Isha
as well.
Will do, yeah.
Oh, he was brilliant.
Well,
yeah.
It was so lovely and personal and. I mean, I get on well with Felix anyway. We met at a White Album themed event. We were on a panel. This is a couple of years ago. We had to talk about White Album together, and I remember saying at the time the White Album was my favorite Beatles album, and it was at the time.
Yeah,
but actually, when all is said and done, I have to say Revolver is the one that's been my favorite for most of my life. You know, like it's always been number one up to the age of about 30, and then there have been times in my life when I've preferred the White Album or even Abbey Road to listen to.
Yes,
but Revolver is just the supreme, to me it's the supreme achievement of that band.
Yeah, I think Felix said something along those lines where he was saying, like, the White Album, you can kind of grow up with it, but Revolver, he still loves for the reasons he loved when he first bought it. It's just that solid rock.
Yeah. It's a moment of perfect balance in the Beatles story for me. And I've got really great memories of the White Album. I used to do my homework to it. It's a great homework record.
Really?
Or if you've got stuff you're writing up on, you know, like of an evening, it has a really good calming effect on your mind and you can focus somehow. I don't know why. It's just that pastoral, grainy sort of thing the White Album's got. But Revolver, kind of on first hearing of it, it's like a lightning bolt moment. And I don't know whether I would have wanted to be in a band quite so much without Revolver.
Really?
In terms of the guitar sounds, the sonics, the excitement of it. And just as well, the feeling that it's just a perfect moment and it's such a blueprint for how to be in a band.
Yeah.
The sleeve design, the photo of them on the back cover, which is one of the coolest photos I've ever seen of the... Oh, there it is. Yeah. I've got my copy here as well.
Have you? Oh, you've got an original one. Is that...
This is a mono original.
Oh, wow.
But I bought it in like 1991 for 12 quid.
Really? Wow.
But it's worth a lot now. It's worth...
Yeah, there's a brilliant YouTube channel, Parlagram Auctions. Have a look at that, and he goes through all the prices and that, so...
How could you tell from this iPhone picture that it was original?
From the back with the fold down.
Oh, this part.
Yeah, mine's a 70s one. So it's just that.
Ah, right, cool.
But yeah, that's that Robert Whittaker photo. That sums up Britpop for me.
Definitely, it's a great photo, and the black and whiteness. I don't know another record where the sound of it is so tied up with the visual of it for me.
Yes, yeah.
It looks like it sounds. It's got this high contrast black and white. It's like, you know, high contrast black and white film, like contrasty film, like it sounds like that.
Yes.
Like it's in terms of its sonics, they made a virtue out of its limitations because they were trying to get to a different studio to get a better bass sound and a bigger sound.
Yeah, they wanted to go to the States.
Is that right?
Yeah, they're talking about stacks and things like that. So.
Yeah, and I guess you can hear that soul influence coming through, but that would have been a terrible idea.
Yeah.
I think the limitations, but in their limitations, the kind of inventiveness of Abbey Road is just so integral to the sound. Like, over the whole album, even the stuff that's quite kind of sweet and pretty still sounds really edgy and gnarly and sort of like on the prettier songs, they still have these great crunchy guitar sounds on them. And it's just a sense of excitement that you feel the Beatles are excited to make these sounds. The producers are excited because they're doing all this new stuff like close miking and they're building special boxes to kind of get over the limitations of the, you know, the bouncing.
Yeah.
Because without getting too muso about it all, the four-track recording is very limited, isn't it?
Mm.
As we all know who grew up with four-track tape recorders, you have to bounce carefully. And
what did you... I had a Fostex. What did you have?
Yeah, I think it was a Fostex or a Tascam. Yeah. I think I had both at different times. Yeah. They're a great education in recording, and you can do your own backwards guitars on them as well because you just turn the cassette over.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is in effect what the Beatles were doing.
Yeah, but as you're saying, the bouncing, every time you do it, you're going to lose something. But...
Yeah, anyone who's done it on cassette knows that it gets more and more muffled and you get more and more hiss. So they had the brilliant engineers at Abbey Road build them these boxes, didn't they, that were like presence boosters. So every time they bounced, they whacked up the high end.
Yeah.
And this is the necessity being the mother of invention. It's the ultimate proof of that because it ends up with one of the great, well, arguably the greatest record ever made.
Definitely. Because we must mention Jeff Emerick, because this was his first Beatles album. And he had been working at E&I for a while. I think he started pretty well when they went in for the How Do You Do It sessions. So their paths didn't quite cross. But he was doing a lot of mastering, and he was doing mastering of Motown songs as well. So he was saying when he was doing that, he was picking up oh yeah, the bass is much heavier on there. So he was kind of working it out for himself, aside from the Beatles.
Yeah.
And obviously Ken Townsend was doing all the artificial double tracking, ADT. So all this stuff was going on. It's that serendipity of the Beatles again. All this was happening at the same time, just as they were thinking, yeah, we want to experiment.
It's a perfect storm of different things altogether, I think, because the technology that they're kind of working with, it's still primitive enough to sound exciting. Like, it's not got too slick yet, and they haven't got that big bass sound yet. I mean, there's no sub bass on Revolver. It's all kind of low mids and high end, but it's all so perfectly weaponized in the mix.
Yeah.
Like, it's so focused and I mean, as a guitarist, that is what you're looking for. It's the detail and the kind of music that I've made all my life has always been about middle detail in the middle, density in the middle. Ride's all about that, and all guitar music to an extent is about how many guitars can I squeeze into this track.
Because Ride used to do Tomorrow Never Knows, didn't you?
We did, and it's funny because I pulled my lyrics book. This is my original, well, not you know, my childhood copy of the Beatles lyrics.
Wow.
And I was looking through, just cause that might be a good reference for talking to you. And when I got to Tomorrow Never Knows, I've written all over the page. I've written all these notes on it. And it just says, like, Andy Starr, Lawrence come in after two lines. Yeah.
Super.
And I've put lines in for different verses.
Oh, yeah.
It's all a one long.
Yeah, you can't see where the spaces are. Superb.
Yeah.
Oh, that was brilliant.
But we used to do Tomorrow Never Knows. Live. We brought it back recently. I love playing it.
Yeah. It's quite ambitious of all the Beatles songs. It's like doing Revolution Number 9.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, that's the confidence of youth, isn't it? It's a bit like me doing a podcast about Revolver as well.
Well, yeah.
Just grasp the biggest one. But Tomorrow Never Knows, our version's quite a straight ahead, heads down version. We're not trying to be as out there as the original version. You couldn't do that.
It's very good though.
Oh, thanks.
So the album was released on the 5th of August 1966 in the UK and 3 days later in the US. And it took an unprecedented 3 months to record between the 6th of April and 22nd of June. So it's for the first time really in a while they'd had some space. And all they had really was, I think it was a BBC interview on the NME poll winners show on the 1st of May. Their last UK performance in front of a crowd. And the album, as always, was produced by George Martin, but as we said before, Jeff Emmerich came in. He was actually replacing Normal Smith. And yeah, as we were saying, I think he and Ken and George were absolutely key into the soundscape. But one thing I did have a look at, when they went into the studio to do this, because it's definitely got a heavier sound, say, to Rubber Soul. But in the UK Top 40, when they went into the studio, so in the charts, you've got things like the Yardbirds, Shapes of Things.
Yeah.
The Who, Substitute. Stones' 19th Nervous Breakdown. And even Dave Dean's Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch with Hold Tight. Which is a very heavy song for a, you know, quite a lightish band. So the soundscape of the 60s, I think it must have informed them a bit, as well as Dylan.
Yeah.
I think they went in with possibly an agenda to make things heavy.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that's interesting to hear that. It wasn't just them. Yeah, that's it. That is kind of, I mean, I know that take on a lot from Motown, and I never think about them taking on board musical competition from pop bands, apart from the Beach Boys. I wouldn't have thought they would have been worried about, you know, what, like, the Spencer Davis Group or Jeff Beck Group were doing, or any of them lot. I think with Revolver, their heads were elsewhere. I mean, for me, they're, at least Paul, who is kind of the leader of the sound at this point, I think, in terms of getting ideas into the music, is it's all like Lamont Young and John Cage and Stockhausen and sort of Steve Reich, maybe. I don't know what he was into, but it's all that kind of minimalist stuff is working its way in a kind of conceptual way. And in obviously a real way. I think that's where Paul's head's at. George is obviously starting to get into the Indian thing, and John is going on a real inner voyage into himself.
Yeah.
And he's being very experimental with his own psyche.
Yeah. Very well put.
So yeah, I think that they are all in these different headspaces that just come together in balance, and they're all also still 100% invested in the Beatles. They're liable to go and buy an island at any point and live together, and you know, they'll buy houses next door to each other probably, and they're just in that glow still. And you know, I picture John sitting happily in his garden in suburbia, tripping and watching daytime TV, and Paul skipping along from Jane Asher's house into central London to go and listen to some original William Burroughs cut-up tapes or something, like just on a day like this in London, and just sort of feeling like all's well with the world. We are currently the most exciting thing going, and isn't it great?
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2.
Let me tell you. One for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
So should we start with track one?
Yeah, why not?
Which was recorded on 21st, 22nd of April and also 21st of June. It's George's Tax Man.
Okay, well, I love the counting on this. It's, you just hear this very cinema verite sort of like snarly counting with someone shouting over the top, and it doesn't really count it in at all, does it?
No, it's just numbers.
Falling down 3-4, you're in, you know. Yeah, it really sets the tone for it. It's something's off about it. Like, you're not hearing 1, 2, 3, 4, because on, I just occurred to me now that doesn't Please Please Me start with I Saw Her Standing There, which has got a counting on it?
Yeah.
So there's your regular counting, and here's your slightly off-kilter acid counting, you know. But yeah, Taxman itself is, for me, it's a vehicle for the greatest guitar solo ever recorded, which is Paul McCartney on a Epiphone Casino. I had to ask Gem Archer for some help with this stuff, because I'm not the best at knowing these details, but I did know that Paul played it, but I wanted to know what it was on, so I checked with my with my Beatles consultant, the guru.
It's the 0800 lumber.
Yeah. I think he just bought a Casino, and then after he'd got it, the other guys got them as well. The solo on Taxman is just so angry and aggy. It's just snarling and very Eastern sounding.
Yeah.
He just managed, I think what Paul does on this record, which I prefer 100,000% to what he does a year later, is he packages all of the out there influences into an album that on the surface appears to be just like Please Please Me, because it's like 14 tracks, they're all 2.5 minutes long, they're all the same. I mean, you know, the ones that aren't a band format, they're a string section. So they're not too crazy in terms of what's on them, but he just smuggles all this stuff into them, like all the Indian influence on that guitar solo, and then the ultimate children's song, Yellow Submarine, is almost like a Stockhausen collage at times.
Mm.
But yeah, so Paul plays this guitar solo. As far as the song itself, it's got a great bass line, it's got a great beat, it's got a great sound, but a shameful moment for George Harrison lyrically. I mean, just shut up and pay your taxes, George.
It was the theme.
Sorry, George.
It was the theme throughout his career, wasn't it, really? Bless him.
I love George, but yeah, that's brain fart.
There was some original lyrics that he didn't use. Don't give in to conformity and all this kind of thing, which thankfully... But you forget, he is still really a kid.
There is so much brilliant about George Harrison that and even on Revolver as well, like there's so much brilliant about him that we can forgive him this one slip up, can't we?
Yeah.
As a great man once said, true perfection has to be imperfect. Revolver can't be perfect, fully perfect.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, one of the very first singles I bought, it may have been the first, I've claimed it was in the past, which was The Jam, Start, famously rips off this riff with another brilliant snarling guitar solo on it.
Mm.
Same kind of sound. But I mention that because I am not even sure which one I heard first. I probably heard The Jam first and then at some point got Revolver. Uh-huh. And it kind of was a nice instructive lesson in that thing that talent borrows, genius steals, because that's the way to do it. Do it with style and just say, yep, and?
Yes. Oh, it is very blatant. Now you've said that, I'm pretty sure that's the same with me, because Start was, what, 80, I think?
Yeah, 1980, yeah.
So, yeah, I wouldn't have had Revolver till a couple of years after. So, yeah, I would have heard Start before.
Yeah.
Oh.
With its own Eleanor Rigby on the B-side with Liza Radley.
Yes, I know, yes. Yeah. I think, did Paul Weller say something like, oh, I've just been listening to a lot of Beatles lately, and that was it. All right, fine. Okay.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Fair play.
Yeah, but what a riff. I mean, it's...
What a riff.
It reminds me of a similar start to Rubber Soul with Drive My Car. That's got the same sort of... That is such a powerful riff and bass and drums working together. But this is so tight.
It's the kind of riff that when you come up with it, you're like, this one should start the record. You know, because from an insider band point of view, you're always thinking, which song will start? What's the first single? You know, what's the last track? And when you've got your bookends, you do breathe a little sigh of relief. You know, normally you do go in, like, which happens on the sessions. I know that Tomorrow Never Knows was the first song to be recorded. It's almost like they came in bursting to record the big statement.
Yeah.
And then relaxed and started to do the other songs, you know.
Yes.
Definitely an album opener.
Look at all the lovely people. Look at all the lovely people. Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for?
So track two, and this was released as a double A-side single with Yellow Submarine. Just imagine as a single, Eleanor Rigby.
Yeah. It's quite a different... I'm quite surprised to think about it being a single. But then again, I wouldn't know what other ones would be singles. It's not a very singly album, is it? Like... I mean, anything you pick off it... I mean, I guess Yellow Submarine is the only one, the other one.
Yeah. Yeah, you think about it. I mean...
Here, there and everywhere, but then that's on its own is sort of too soft, isn't it?
Yes, it needs the context of the album.
It's part of... The album works so well as a whole and it's allowed to have extremes, even soft extremes, because they all work as part of this bigger picture. So yeah, Eleanor Rigby, it's an incredible lyric, isn't it?
Yes.
It's a real... The themes that Paul writes about on this album are very... very sad. Like, this is loneliness and dying alone and these characters in the song. His character songs can be, at times you're just thinking, I don't really know why he's writing about these people, but in this one it just really hits home. You've got this this lady who's living a sad, single, lonely life. And then the priest, I think the idea is that the priest presides over the funeral. Is that right?
Mm.
Or Father McKenzie? Like, so he holds the funeral service, but he's never met the woman. And my favourite line is it, my favourite line in it is, no one was saved.
Oh,
it's such a, like, blind. He's just like, you know, wiping his hands, walking from the grave. No one was saved. Like, it's all so hopeless, isn't it?
It's amazing.
It's just so, oh, bloody hell, Paul. It's, wow. Just another day, another funeral.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Think at the time, he was living with Jane Asher's parents, and he was going to the Indica, and like you say, it's to Stockhausen. But this could be a 1966 movie.
Yeah.
The plot of this is so dark. And
Kathy come home, yes. Sort of gritty English drama. Yeah.
Yeah. Julie Christie would be in it.
Yeah.
Tom Courtney.
She'd be Eleanor Rigby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to cast this now, but it's an astonishing, and there's no, I mean, you think yesterday before this with the, you know, the string quartet on this, that's yeah. literally it. There's no, it's just vocals and a string. And it's such a, like you say, you think about releasing a single from this album. Blimey, this doesn't seem on paper to be commercial. I suppose the only way it is commercial is if you do it as a double A side with Yellow Submarine.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. So even in that context of the single, you need to have another song with it to bolster it and make, you know, it's not enough. The songs on their own are all so much part of the team of songs that they need their friends with them.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about something you just said there. It's gone out of my head. Never mind.
Casting the film?
It's definitely gone.
Right. Okay. Similarly, strangely, one of the lines that always jumps out is darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there.
Oh, I've remembered it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So do you think that talking about the lines in the song, because I know Paul asked for help from his bandmates and his mates as well. I think he maybe wanted to make the writing of the lyrics a team effort because he knew that the music would be just strings, you know, like, so he wanted to have the lads on board, you know.
Yeah.
But some of the best stuff is from the contributions of his bandmates.
Yeah. Well, Donovan was there as well. I think John got a bit annoyed about it as well because he was, you know, kind of it's usually you and me throwing it out to everybody to throw in a line. Bless him.
Oh, yeah.
He was being, you know, possessive about his songwriting partner.
Well, yeah.
Pure John, yeah. Really.
He would have felt the threat of that, I guess. When I wake up early in the morning, lift my head, I'm still yawning. When I'm in the middle of a dream, stay in bed, float upstream.
Track three, talking of John.
Yeah.
This is the king of lethargy. I'm only sleeping.
This is a very, very lovable John Lennon track by a lovable version of John. I really like this John Lennon, who's just a suburban dude tripping in his front room, you know, like, just like, there's that picture of him, I think the picture's from a bit later, but that Safe as Milk picture,
yes, yeah,
is sort of in a bit more of his Pepper era, but he's lying on a lovely looking sofa with a poster, Safe as Milk. I think he's just safe there,
yeah,
having his inner voyages. Is where was he? Weybridge, was it?
Yeah,
yeah. But I'm Only Sleeping is just a lovely, lovely tune. Kind of like a lot of his later Beatles songwriting. Obviously, I'm So Tired is a relation of it. Happiness is a Warm Gun. It's kind of like moving towards the White Album sound. Mm. That laconic, laid-back John, who's not as angry as he used to be, at the moment anyway.
Mm.
And just watching the world go by. Watching the wheels, you might say, even.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so.
So, I mean, he's... Yeah, yeah, I mean... The acid certainly seems to be calming him down. So, yeah, as I say, I love this John. And it's kind of him absorbing new influences, but like I say, just within himself rather than being out there in London. I think they're very much because they're so symbiotic, he's aware, obviously, they must be talking on the phone a lot and seeing each other a lot and talking, exchanging their experiences. And as much as Paul was a little bit more reticent about the psychedelics, I think John was a bit more reticent about going out and meeting new people and you know, taking on board sort of pretentious art stuff, that I think he was happy to let Paul go and explore all that and come back and report back, you know. And then John could sort of cherry pick the best bits and sort of feed back to Paul that way, say, well, let's do the tape loop thing or the backwards masking thing, or not backwards masking, just backwards solos and backwards voices. And
yeah,
you know.
And you think, since, well, the Quarrymen, he'd been the leader for the whole thing, you know, pulling the, come on, you know, where are we going, to the top of most and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think from 66, really, he was kind of happy to relinquish his leadership because he knew Paul could take over.
I think he was happy to relinquish his leadership at Woolton Village Fete, personally. I think he was like, this dude is like musically got it. He's good looking. He's smart. We are on the same page mentally. I think he had the leader energy about him in a personal sense, but in a deep sense, I think that he knew what he was getting into with McCartney right from minute one. Yeah, John is the sort of de facto leader of the band as far as everyone else is concerned, but within the band, I think they all have their roles perfectly balanced. And you know, in the studio, Paul will be more the more musical, technically musical person. And it just balances out really well at this point. And then a bit later, it starts to just get sour, you know, and start to pull apart.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm only sleeping. There's just, it conjures up the lyrics so well. It's one of the few songs I know with a yawn in it.
Yeah.
Perfect time.
It makes you yawn. It makes you yawn. Is there a yawn on it?
Yeah. It's just around that song. Ba-dum, dum, dum.
Oh yeah, there is. Yeah, it sounds so sleepy in the backward guitar. I mean, that's one thing about you know, we were chatting earlier about the mono and stereo versions.
Yeah,
they're entirely different, the backward stuff, aren't they?
Yes.
This whole mono stereo thing, I mean, God, I've spent so much of my life chasing a dream of, I mean, this is one of the main reasons I was kind of confused about Spotify when it first came out, is that, well, how will they know which is the version, you know, like, what are we going with here, you know? But I think on balance, having chased down pretty much every different version of Revolver, my favorite one is the 80s CD.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why that's the one, but I think it's the one you grow up with, maybe is going to have the most resonance. But
yeah,
any other time I hear it, it doesn't sound quite like it.
Wow. I do remember when the CD came out, it's the astonishing silence between the tracks. It's like, well, where's the crackling? Yeah. It was bizarre.
Yeah. I heard words I'd never heard before, because on the records I'd played them so much, they used to skip. The stylus would skip over a line and you'd be like, oh, there's another line of music in there.
And also, one final thing, again, the this one for Ken Townsend's ADT, it just sounds so good, track in particular, I think. John's so rich, pouring through the speakers.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really lovely sounding vocal on that, yeah, for sure. A quintessential John Lennon song, really is.
Four, another George Harrison contribution, Love You Too.
Yeah, I've always wondered about this. Whether I've always thought that it was Love You Too, as in I love you too. Like, yeah. I love you, George. I love you too. You know, like, but is there an Omistoff, or is it just Love You Too, something like Love You to What?
Well, anyway, he sings I'll Make Love to You, doesn't he? So maybe it's something around that. Love You to.
So it should be called Love to You. It should be called Love to You then. Weird. But it's, again, like The Counting, it's just off in a way that you just take on board. This is Revolver world. We're not in Kansas anymore. We're not in Rubber Soul land anymore. This is the first time that they are sonically really drawing from a new, painting from a new palette, you know.
Mm.
Incredible rhythm guitar sound on this, on the choruses. The distorted, bad, sort of little, it's like a little horn stab, but a distorted guitar.
Yeah.
It just all sounds so menacing and evil, basically. For a song about love, it's very dark sounding.
And, it is.
No idea what the lyrics are about. I think it's just word salad, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. There's some crazy lines in there. Again, George, he was very young at the time. But I think I said it before, the line, make love singing songs. I don't know.
It kind of, it does have an internal logic of a kind of stoned, spiritually awakened, laconic George Harrison lying in bed, just sort of, I don't know, like just sort of loved up, but kind of at the same time quite lethargic.
Yeah.
You know, it hangs together, but I don't think it's very clear. It's not as clear as some of the other songs, exactly what he's trying to say there, but it's still brilliant. And he sings it in a really great accent, really strong Liverpool accent, which I love about it.
Yeah.
I think it's people screaming. There's certain lines in it. In the verses,
screw
where he's just
in the ground.
Yeah. I think it's my favorite George Easton song. I mean, I like Within You, Without You, but it's very long. It's a bit long. This is Easton, but with it's still, like I say, it hasn't gone too far out. It's just absorbed into pop music, so it's still pop music.
Mm.
Just about.
It's very It's a definite East-West crossover, I think. Yeah, because it's almost like a dance record. It reminds me more of something from the 90s. So you've got this sort of heavy bass drum, well, tabla or whatever, but it sounds like a bass drum, with like roaring, screaming guitars, you know, full of fuzz guitars, as I was still calling them.
Yeah. Well, this song and Tomorrow Never Knows both echoed out into the 90s with when the Chemicals were sort of collaborating with Noel on tracks and, psychedelic dance music and rock music. It's kind of somewhere, it kind of links forward to that somehow.
To lead a better life, I need my love to be here. Making each day of the year, changing my life with a wave of the hand. Nobody.
Next, Paul, with Here, There and Everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, this is a track that could have easily been on with the Beatles, I suppose. Like, it could be a real early, almost like a Hamburg ballad track. But it's still a lovely song, lovely song. Do you think it's like a Jane Asher love song? Like a love song for Jane?
I think so, yeah.
It's a lovely tune. I mean, even like I was saying earlier, the guitars on it still have a bite to them. It's not sentimental, and what saves it is the production, the sonics that we've touched on already a bit, but these treble boxes that they were using on or the Presence boxes, I think they were called, these beautiful looking grey metal custom built things with a big Bakelite dial on it that's just like volume, and then a smaller one for choosing the EQ that you want to either cut or boost. I think they started off being used as a tool to solve a problem, and then ended up by this point being used for fun on everything. You know, like they'd bring out the box for vocals, bass, guitar, drums, and then I think on reverbs and stuff too. Like they'd use it on the echo chamber to dial out certain frequencies and really choose what frequencies to push. So they're really getting into some great production things for the. The limitations they had was just incredible to produce these sounds from it.
Yes.
Which is just, that's just not there to the same level on Rubber Soul.
No. It's weird because it's what you were saying earlier about there's no sort of obvious singles. I think they did go into this with a different attitude. So Rubber Soul, because it was effectively a rushed album, they were trying to get it out for Christmas. So they were doing like overnight, you know, actually recording through the night for the first time, which they'd not really done before to that extent. So they've kind of gone straight in with that attitude. And they, like I say, it took 3 months really to make. And they didn't, you know, they had all this time off. They could have done it in a couple of weeks and then had a couple of months off, but they didn't. Yeah. So there's so much time and effort. They wanted it to be an album.
Sure. And it feels like it is an album. And in between, you know, you have plenty of time to be living your man about town life, hanging out at the Indigo Gallery with Barry Miles and John Dunbar and
Robert Fraser.
Going to mad Cornelius Cardew concerts that are shit. But there's a good quote about that, because I was reading about that. Paul went to this John Cage influenced concert with Cornelius Cardew and then came out of it and was like, you don't have to like something to be influenced by it. I like that quote because it sort of it shows where Paul's head went. It's just, well, it's like I recognize the idea and I will use that idea. I will ruthlessly milk everything that happens to me for ideas that I'll then put into Beatles stuff and make them better, you know.
Yes. I think I love this as well. The chord sequence for me is very reminiscent of John's If I Fell. And also later John would also use it for Woman.
Right.
So it's a nice little
sort
of three-part thing there. But I love, because Paul wrote it, he was just, he was at John's, it's just the decadence of it all. He was around John's house in Weybridge and they were sitting by the swimming pool. Or sorry, Paul was sitting by the swimming pool, but waiting for John to wake up. Which I love. It's just, I'll just sit by the swimming pool and write this song, you know, which I love. And similarly, they did a thing in the 70s when John was in LA in 74. Paul went over to see him and he had to wait till 3 p.m. and he was sitting by the pool with Keith Moon and Harry Nilsson waiting for John to get up. So he was kind of used to it.
Going for it. It's back on UK time by that point, isn't he?
Oh, yeah.
This is the song with the real... are you a Lars fan? Do you like the Lars?
Oh, yes, I do.
Yeah, because this has that amazing Snake Charmery guitar part on the... I guess you call it the middle eight. Just to love her. Yeah. And it's sort of... it's a... what I like about this arrangement is that it's not sentimental. It's like a kind of Lars version of a ballad arrangement. I think that either the Lars have studied the Beatles that much that they took that on board, or there's just something about Liverpool that, you know, the docks, or there's something about the influences that at work in Liverpool which have just permeated into this kind of... it is like a sort of seafaring... I don't know what it is, but it's like a kind of mood that I get off a lot of Liverpool music that I really like.
In the town where I was born lived a man who sailed to sea, and he told us of his life in the land of submarines. So we sailed unto the sun,
So next we have Ringo, Yellow Submarine.
Yeah. When I was a teenager, I used to put these, I used to put albums I had onto cassette. So I had a C60 and had Rubber Soul and Revolver on this cassette. But obviously they're slightly more than 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So I just lopped off Yellow Submarine. It was just like, yeah, that's out straight away. and then I don't know what song I took off Rubber Soul. What's the...
I'll Run For Your Life, probably.
No, I kind of like that. The other one is the country one about
what goes on.
They're going to put me in a movie.
Oh no, that's Act Naturally. Oh, that's Help. Act Naturally from Help.
Is that? Oh, so what did you say then?
What goes on in your heart? What goes on?
Yeah, it could have been that one. Anyway, Yeah, anyway, I had to take one off. Whatever one it was, I'll find out and let you know. We'll update the show notes with the...
You've still got a C60.
I might have. Oh. I might. I've got a box of cassettes, yeah. Anyway, I think since having had now four kids, and they vary in age from now, the oldest one is 22 and the youngest is 7, each one of those kids has been hooked into the Beatles by Yellow Submarine.
Really?
Well, you know, either the song or the film or just the cartoon pictures or something about this song is magical for kids. And I've noticed it four different times. It's not a fluke. It just has a kid magic about it. So yeah. I have to give it credit for that. And, you know, it does have experimental stuff about it. And that's, again, the Beatles smuggling in some grown-up experimental stuff onto a kid's song. You've got to respect that.
Yeah. And I love the... Sorry, Karen.
Yeah, no. Were you going to say you love the backing vocals?
Yes. Go on. Yeah.
The call and response stuff. Yeah, the... what is it again now? What am I thinking of? I've forgotten how it goes.
Sky blue.
Oh, yeah. All the little repeats and stuff.
As we live a life of ease, every one of us has all we need.
And all we need.
So you've got backing vocals, you've got basically it's the whole Beatles world. So you've got Neil Aspinall, Mal Evans is doing the big bass drum, George Martin singing along, Jeff Emerick, Patty is on there, Brian Jones from the Stones, Marian Faithfull, wow. And I love the Beatles chauffeur Alf Bicknell, he's on there as well.
And oh, brilliant.
You could just picture it, right? We need a big roaring vocal.
Yeah.
Come on, Alf.
Yeah.
Stop playing chess. But it's beautiful. Excellent. And I think it's sort of, for Paul and Ringo, it points the way towards things like We All Stand Together and Thomas the Tank. And what you were saying about your kids as well, so many people have said it when they're at school.
Yeah.
And their kids love it. Because Ringo has got the ability to not patronise. He's like Derek Griffiths. I used to love Derek Griffiths because he spoke to us at that level. Ringo kind of.
He's just natural. Yeah, he's very natural on record and on screen. And whenever you come across him, he's just relatable.
Yeah,
and he's just a lovely man, isn't he?
The inside one with completely different sound. She said.
Yeah. Now this is along with Tomorrow Never Knows, my most played track on Revolver. I remember just blasting it over and over again. Just I could not get enough of it. It's the screaming way that the guitar comes in to open the track. And as a teenager, the family got hold of a radiogram at one point, which I think belonged to my grandparents, and they moved house and to a smaller place. And so we got their radiogram, and I just said, I want that in my room, please. And I managed to get it. And you know what they're like, these old chests? They're very heavy, and they've got the speakers all built in, like woven speakers that you could lean. I used to sit on the floor leaning up on the speakers, and you could really get, I mean, I'd feel sorry for my poor folks because I used to blast it really loud. Yeah. 19th Nervous Breakdown by the Stones was a big favourite.
That was it.
And then she said, and then like the Who records as well had Meaty, Beaty, Big and Bouncy, so we used to give that loads as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, like these records, but especially She Said, it's just so like a blueprint of guitar music for me.
Mm.
And also, not just the guitars, but the drums on this record are absolutely incredible. There's a thing with it where there's space. The pace of it is perfect. It's not too fast, so there is space for all of these fills to be really heard, and the toms, the snare, the cymbals, the massive wash of the cymbal crashes when they come in, but then it dies down and you can hear the toms rolling round, and I think it is that kind of surgical precision of EQ. Again, where they know what they're cutting, what they're boosting, and they're able to find a pocket of space for the drums to have their own moment within everything else, you know?
Yeah, on that, you're making me feel like I've never been born. It's literally an explosion of cymbals, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It just takes over. And you're making me feel like I've never been born.
And no Paul on this. It's just John, Paul and George, because Paul walked out.
What do you mean?
There was a bit of an argument while they were recording this.
No, didn't play bass on it?
No, he walked out. This was the last song to be recorded for the album. And
she said not got Paul on it.
No Paul. George is on bass. There's some great photos, George playing the bass as well. So it's a very strange lineup, and it's a good lineup.
That might be why the drums have so much space, because Paul would, you know, as much as we love when he does it, the bass would be spidering away all over that drum pattern, wouldn't it? But now the drums are allowed to have their own moment.
Yeah.
Wow. That's,
well, George would have kept it simple, brilliant. Wouldn't he?
Yeah, he would have kept it simple, yeah.
And Ringo is in top form at this time.
Absolutely. Yeah. So great. Ringo's drumming, I mean, Ringo's drumming makes Tomorrow Never Knows, it makes this, it's, total masterclass. There's a few songs where, I guess she said, lyrically, it's about that, it's that story, isn't it, about them taking LSD with the guy from Easy Rider.
Peter Fonda.
Yeah. At some LA party, and they came home remembering this story. So I guess that's good. But I think beyond that, it's kind of like there are songs on the album where we'll come to them in a minute. But there are workmanlike moments on the record where the drums don't quite lift it out of there. But when she said that the drums just make it sit at the top table of Beatles songs.
Well, I guess that you think about it, this was the same, musically, the same lineup as The Who, just bass, guitar and drums for the first time for the Beatles.
Mm. Yeah. She said, you don't understand what I said. I said, no, 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 you're wrong. When I was a boy, everything was right.
Also, we must mention the bridge with those strange "When I was a boy" and the strange time signatures on that. It's very surreal writing.
It is very. So it's it's a John Lennon song, isn't it? And I've got so many bootlegs. Like, I don't know about you, but during the 90s, I was just always finding bootleg CDs of one more Revolver outtakes bootleg, you know, and like there's all these versions. She said went through all these different changes of he said and you know, and one thing you get when you get about John when you hear his demos is that timing is an abstract concept for him, isn't it? It's like he could play the same song as a waltz or as 4/4 as whatever it came out that moment. So Paul's got a way more structured vision of when I write a song, this is the riff, you know. Whereas John is delivering feelings and emotions and you know, lyrics, and the vehicle might be a Mini or a Rolls Royce, you know. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. I need to laugh. And when the sun is out, I've got something I can laugh about. I feel good in a special way. I'm in love and it's a sunny day. So flipping over to side two, originally titled A Good Day Sunshine, recording during the hot summer of 66, it's Good Day Sunshine. Lovely. And you can just feel that World Cup win. Summer of 66. Yeah, this is the one where I picture Paul just skipping along around St. John's Wood. Yeah, I mean, this is Paul. I just think this has got the optimism of someone who is just happy in a happy time in their life and firing on all cylinders. And I mean, musically, it's got that kind of, is it? It's kind of just a general mid-60s pop song. Could have been a Kinks song, possibly. Like, it's got that slightly musical thing, but rock and roll. But yeah, I mean, it's London is great in the sunshine, and I can feel that feeling. And it is, like I say, it's all tied in with Revolver for me. It's them in London, or it's more than any of the other ones.
Paul said it was based on very much a nod to Loving Spoonful's What a Day for a Daydream.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I get that. Yeah.
And I was looking at the dates because this was recorded on, well, they first started recording on the 8th of June, but on April the 18th, John and George actually went to see them, Loving Spoonful, at the Marquee. So I think, yeah, he's heard that. But again, that Loving Spoonful song could be written in London in the 60s as well.
Yeah.
It's just that overall sound. I'd love to have been there. Wow.
Tell me that you've got everything you want and your bird can sing, but you don't get me. You don't get me. You say you've seen seven wonders and your
next, we have Paul and George's harmonising guitar riffs on And Your Bird Can Sing.
I was going to ask you who played what. That's good to know. Did you say Paul and George on guitars?
Yeah.
Yeah. Another of my favourite sounding ones. The guitars are just so present and bright, but at the same time, grainy. It's just the harmonised lead lines are so well executed. It's just so satisfying to hear, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a solid song as well, like an anti-materialist sort of theme to it. You can have all the stuff for you. It's almost like a precursor to Imagine in a way, isn't it? Like, you can have all the possessions in the world, but it won't make you happy. Have I read that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me that you got everything you want and your bird can sing.
Mm.
Almost can't buy me love. Actually, this...
But you don't get me. It's a bit of aggro to it. It's like you can have everything in the world, but you don't get me.
Yeah,
sort of thing. Which could be you don't get to have me, or you don't understand me.
Yeah, both really with John, I think. Yeah, but what I was going to say as well, I love this special. This was recorded on the 26th of April, but on the 20th of April, a week before, they did the version that's on Anthology with all the giggling and laughing.
Oh yeah, yeah,
which
yeah,
is I love beautiful. That version. Yeah, and it's very birds. Birdsy sounding.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. What do I know? But if I'd recorded that first version, I would have thought, wow, this is superb. Obviously, lose the laughter. But they obviously wanted it to be heavier because this is a much heavier sounding recording. Yeah. So they went in with a definite agenda, I think. Mm. But the first one's so good.
Interesting. Yeah, it's a brilliant version. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's fun to play these songs when they're new, you know. It's actually kind of good fun to go and play them again. It's like, is it done already? Now let's have another go at it. You know, I think you can imagine them wanting to go in and do it again for the crack, really.
Your day breaks, your mind aches. You find that all her words of kindness linger on when she no longer needs you. She wakes up, she makes up. She takes her time and doesn't feel she has to hurry. She no longer needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing. No sign of love behind the tears cried for no one. A love that should have lasted years.
Next we have For No One.
This is a mind-blowing track for me. It's a sign of things to come with Paul. I think it's got the shades of She's Leaving Home and songs he'd later come to do on his own. It's got a little shade. It's the closest thing on the album to Sgt. Pepper. But I think for me, it's head and shoulders above anything on Pepper. It's so well done. And it's the levels of empathy to write this lyric for someone that's in their 20s. I mean, it's about things that I didn't understand until I was in my 40s. It's so extremely touching and well written. Like, it's poetry. It's brilliant. And that's without touching on the music, which is beautiful.
You want her, You need her, and yet you don't believe her. When she says her love is dead, you think she needs you.
But it's a definite link with She's Leaving Home, I think. Again, another story.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And about loneliness as well.
Yeah. About loneliness and also not realising when your relationship's over, you know, like it's kind of not letting go. It's just so, there's so much in it. It's brilliant. It's genius for no one. Yeah, it's probably, I mean, it's right up there with Eleanor Rigby. I think I probably like it even more. It's just really, it's really special.
Oddly, it was written when he was on holiday with Jane Asher in Switzerland.
Right.
So whether there's... It's quite an awkward... Here, Jane, have a listen to this song I've just written. What do you think?
Brilliant.
Lyrically, I think it's beyond... Just a couple of years ago, they were singing Can't Buy Me Love, and now he's singing songs that could be feature films. It's such a tender age.
When it comes on, I sort of see a feature film in my head. I can sort of... You can see it all play out. I feel like I'm watching a film, hearing it.
Being my friend, I said you called up a robber. Day or night, he'll be there any time at all. Dr. Robert, Dr. Robert, you're a new and better man. He helps you to understand. He does everything he can. Dr. Robert.
So next, Dr. Robert.
Yeah, if there is a filler track on the album, it's probably this, but it's kind of a cool throwaway. I mean, probably the first, is it the first Rock Doctor tune?
I'd say so.
About you. Yeah. I like that, you know, side of it. It's just them and their new world of pills and thrills.
And belly aches.
Getting their prescriptions. yeah. Exactly. The guitars again. The sonics are just great. They lift it. So yeah, I mean it's a cool song. I used to like it a lot more than I mean I think it's, as I've got older, it's the ones like For No One that have grown on me more. And if you'd have asked me for the highlights of Revolver as a 16-year-old, it would have been Dr. Robert, And Your Bird Can Sing, She Said She Said, and Tomorrow Knows probably. It's all those ones, and Taxman. You know, all the rockers. But now I appreciate a lot more of the softer, deeper stuff.
Yeah, I think it's... I would say it's kind of filler myself, but I think its purpose on the album is to... You've just had For No One, a very soft song.
Well, yeah, it's perfectly placed. It's perfectly placed in there, isn't it?
Yeah, and it just keeps it's a that
palate
sound.
Cleanser.
Yeah.
Well,
also the harmonium with a well, sort of like a Christmassy sound. Reminds me of the end of Apples and Oranges by Pink Floyd. Apples and oranges.
Oh, yeah. There's, is it a harmonium on We Can Work It Out?
Yeah.
I think We Can Work It Out is the most underrated Beatles song. I always forget about it. And then whenever I think about it, I always think, it's actually one of my big favourites. It's such a great tune. Obviously from a year or so before all this. But to harmonium raise its head again. Well, you're feeling very Christmassy.
So as that fades out, the next song fades in. It's George's third song, I want to tell you.
So on this one, I think George really plays a blinder with the lyrics. I mean, I think on the lyrics for this, he sums up how all the band are feeling in this period. For me, it's like, I want to express what I'm experiencing, but I haven't quite got the word. I'm struggling to articulate everything that's all the influences I'm taking on board. And so I'm so open, I'm so inspired, and there's so much to take in and so much to enjoy in life, but I can't explain it right because I'm 25, you know, I'm overwhelmed, you know. That's the feeling I get, and I love the way he expresses it in his song. And it's a really cool track. Like, it's a brilliant recording. I don't know what the story is. Maybe you can tell me, with the discordant piano lines on it. The ding, 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 ding. I don't know who did that. I love that.
Cool.
Yeah. The piano on the song really adds a lot to it. And I guess, again, you know, Paul is there throwing in a little bit of highbrow, discordant, something arty, you know.
Yeah.
Give it, every song has got like 15% artiness to it. Yeah. But none of them have got too much artiness, you know, they've all just the right amount.
There's that beautiful moment with Paul and Ringo doing that. And Ringo does that fill. So powerful.
It's a really well arranged song, isn't it? And I think that the Beatles work together as a team really well, and it's still working on full power. They're very happy to help George with his song, make it the best it can be, add lots of ear candy to it, and make it interesting.
And I think also the beginning of the song, also very much reminds me of Got to Get You Into My Life.
Yeah.
It's a similar sort of, you could mash, I might actually mash them together and see if that works. But
go on, have a go.
I will.
I was alone, I took a ride, I didn't know what I would find there. Another road where maybe I could see another kind of mind there. Ooh, then I suddenly see you. Ooh, did I tell you I need you every single day of my life?
Which brings us on to the penultimate track, Got to Get You Into My Life.
Yeah, well, what I've always heard about this is it's a Paul song about discovering weed. Is that
apparently,
what you've heard?
According to Paul, yeah.
Yeah, when you read it as a lyric, it definitely makes sense that way. And he did get it into his life, didn't he?
Yeah, so they say.
Yeah, allegedly. So yeah, I mean, it's a great track. And I think on this you can hear the Motown influence they're talking about. You know, I think maybe this is one of the ones they were thinking of when they were like, let's go to record in America.
Yeah.
Because it, you know, you can hear them going, we want that Motown feel. And but they got it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a great rolling momentum to it that is, that feels very Motown-y.
Definitely. I think Jeff Emmerich would have helped with that as well, because he'd been mastering all those Motown records, so he would have known.
Yeah.
I mean, like you say earlier, then everything's being mic'd up super tight. And it could pass for a Motown song.
Yeah. It was like a job done for all the things they were trying to achieve with the recording in America idea, but they did it in a very British way. They managed to do it with Abbey Road and the gear they had, and with four-track recording and everything about it. We come back to this theme all the time about the limitations, but they really enhance it.
Yeah.
It makes it more than just a Motown-y tribute. It's got all this bite to it as well.
Hard to get you into my life.
Because notably, when they went in the studio, Stevie Wonder was still in the charts with Uptight, which is a similar principle. You've got the four snares, dum, dum, and the bass staying on the root note on the chord, sort of snake around. But it's, again, on the anthology, you've got an early version of this, which is completely different. How they got from that to this, it's a pop song rather than a Motown song.
Ooh, then I suddenly see you. Ooh, did I tell you I need you every single day of my life? Got to get you into my life somehow, some way.
I mean, I'm not trying to knock Pepper, but I do think that this is, again, it's a theme that you, the musical theme that you just come back on Pepper with some of the Good Morning, maybe. And some of the songs have these big horn riffs on them. I just think that, that all that stuff is just done better in Revolver, because it's not quite so, not quite so blatant. It's more absorbed into a rock sound. So yeah. I kind of always will come back to this one. I mean, Pepper is a great album, and especially when you hear, this is the one where you got to hear the mono version. The original mono version of Sgt. Pepper is so much tougher and harder and rockier than the stereo.
Yeah, because George Harrison was moaning about that when they had the 20th anniversary. Right. You're playing the wrong version!
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was really pissed off.
Yeah, you wonder what they thought about that, because obviously as a new technology comes out, like CDs, you know, you're sort of dimly aware of it at first, and then it becomes, then you realise, oh, this is real, this is a, it's not Betamax, this is actually going to be the new standard.
Yeah.
You know, and so by that point, they'd probably already committed to using these almost throwaway stereo mixes that were done. And they weren't present for them, were they, the mixdowns?
Not all, well, 90% no.
So it's just, it's funny the way that we ended up with these versions on the CDs that we all grew up with, that we're so familiar with, and they are the versions to us. But to the Beatles themselves, it's actually, I hadn't heard that, that George said, it's not the real version. I hadn't, I never twigged that. That's pretty classic.
And it was also the version that millions of fans heard at the time as well.
Yeah. So if you were there at the time, you'll be like, this is it, the mono.
Yeah, yeah, mono. Especially this, got to get you into my life in mono. You've got that extra, is it 20 seconds at the end with Paul doing the ad-libbing?
Yeah.
He's going for it.
It's brilliant. Yeah. Or you've got 20 seconds less on the CD, if that's what you're used to.
Well, yeah.
Be shortchanged massively, yeah.
End with the first song to be recorded for the album. It's Tomorrow Never Knows.
Oh, crikey. Here we go.
Over to you.
Yeah, I'm kind of speechless about this, because it's so great. Its influence is so big. It's the encapsulation of this era of the Beatles, and it's also very timeless. John's brilliant lyrics combined with Paul's minimalist influences coming in, and Ringo's incredible drumming, George's Eastern influence, it's all there boiling, bubbling up together in this perfect mixture of sounds, which is all feels brand new and still feels brand new now when you hear it.
Yeah.
It's a true masterpiece. It came from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream, it's not dying. Was it the Timothy Leary version of that book? Is that, I'm
yeah,
always
there
confused.
Was,
with
the Psychedelic Experience by Timothy
Right, and that
Leary,
was a handbook for tripping, was it?
Yeah, basically. It was it was an adaptation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Yeah.
But it was basically a guidebook on how to trip, really.
Yeah. And I guess we could go back and think about the early version with the slightly different beat, the straight beat, which was my favourite track to come out of the anthology era. And it's got that kind of a different kind of sample. It's a sample, isn't it? The tape loops are sort of samples. So the tape loops are different, and it's just got a whole different feel, really. But it's obviously like a signpost on the way to where it was going.
Time off your mind, relax
On this, you can hear the influence of Lamont Young, and that's all this Lamont Young, John Cage stuff. It's funny because it's kind of connected to Yoko Ono, isn't it? She was working with them. She was trying to get to the Beatles, get to Paul or someone in the Beatles who was it to help fund something or contribute to something or other.
Yeah, she asked Paul for some lyrics.
Oh, for lyrics. And then Paul was like, you'd probably do better going to my mate John, sort of thing. And then she ended up with John. But along the way, I think it was just in the air that there was all this minimalist music and modern conceptual art. I don't know what you would call it, really. Yeah, and it was just in the air. And I think Paul particularly was very like a sponge at that point. Like he'd moved in with Jane, and because he was living in the family home, then become matey with Peter Asher. And then you can tell me the ins and outs, but they start knocking about with John Dunbar and Barry Miles at the Indica Gallery. And then it's all about the William Burroughs cut-ups. Paul gets access to the tapes, and then he goes off to hear these minimalist classical concerts and influenced by them. And before you know it, you've got like Lamont Young drones on Tomorrow Never Knows.
And the first version, yeah, which we can hear on Anthology Mark One, is very close to John's original idea. He did want one chord.
Yeah.
Just no change of it. Yeah. You've got that wow, wow loop going on, which gradually goes out of sync. Because Ringo never... It's like, Ringo, you're playing to a sample. What? What? You know.
What's a sample? Well, it hasn't been invented yet, but... Yeah.
I mean, the ultimate version is just... And you've got Paul doing all the backward loops and the seagull noises and everything. It's, you know, they're all put in, so it's all four of them.
Yeah.
All the strengths of all of them are combined in this supercharged, so powerful.
Yeah, very powerful. Yeah, I totally agree. It's all four of them at full strength. Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't put it better myself.
And totally sums up the cover as well. You can't help but stare at... Did you do it when you were as a kid? Just stare at the album while you're listening?
Staring at the album, yeah. And it's quite... There's a lot of humour in the album as well. The way that the illustrations... They've got a little guy playing a little pipe in the hair. And
oh, yeah, yeah.
Like all these little cartoony bits. Like George is inside Paul's ear. Is that George?
Oh, no, yeah.
Like, someone's in there.
Yeah, that looks like George to me.
It's real art. This is so... It's just art, isn't it?
It is.
More than any other record sleeve, front and back. Especially when you have the white fold over bit on the back.
I wouldn't know. So Andy Bell, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. Tell me overall what this album means to you.
This album for me has been with me since I was a teenager, and it sums up everything that I love about bands and the Beatles in particular, and music in general. It's a blueprint for my life in music.
Wow. Andy Bell, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me as well. Thanks, Chris.